How the Devil Are You? I'm your host, Jamie Black, and without hesitation this week, as we have a lot to cover on this dark and stormy night here in Wales, let's set sail into the darkness. Tonight's subject holds some nostalgic feels for me, mainly because I remember initially hearing about this story when I was around 9 or 10 years old. Going through that phase like most young boys do at around that age, I thought of myself as holding all the aspiring attributes of a future pirate. A dashing buccaneer who will sail the seven seas, relieving the wealthy and the treacherous of the ill-begotten spoils of war, and utilizing them for my own nefarious needs. Plus, by my side, a sword-brandishing parrot with eye patch that matched mine because, well, pirates. Being that age, and still naive to the ways of the world, I was of course 100% sure that buried treasure was of course still out there, undiscovered and just waiting for me and my parrot to come along and claim it for our own. So I remember my grandfather taking me to the local library, where my gaze was met by a book about real-life pirates and their buried treasure. So fascinated was I with this book and the stories within, and growing more and more aware of the late fees that were mounting up, fees no doubt that only buried treasure could settle, that I copied the entire book word for word in pencil. This was so that I could always have a copy of the stories, and one particular story from within. The story within, and the subject of tonight's adventure, is still, to this day, unsolved. A centuries-old mystery that has claimed many lives and bankrupt many others in the search for fortune and glory. Tonight's adventure is The Legend and Lore of Oak Island. In researching tonight's episode, I utilized a book written by Darcy O'Connor titled The Secret Treasure of Oak Island, The Amazing True Story of a Centuries-Old Treasure Hunt. It's really a fantastic book, jam-packed with facts and information from the very beginning of this story and right up to the present day. Should you wish to know more about tonight's subject matter, I highly recommend this book above all others. So our story begins some 224 years ago in Nova Scotia, Canada. An area kind of northeast of the US state of Maine. Oak Island is a small island, very small in fact, at only 140 acres, and this is where our adventure will take place. Originally named Gloucester Isle, locals have always referred to it as Oak Island due to the small population of oak trees on the island that, interestingly, are not indigenous to the area, yet no one really knows how they came to grow there. The island is sat in an area called Mahone Bay and is only some 660 feet from the mainland, with the nearest town being Chester a few miles away. To get some bearings, the island is around 26 kilometres, or 16 miles southwest of Halifax, the largest city in the county. The area is known to have many stories and pirate lore in its history, and some of that will link into tonight's episode. In 1795, a young man, I say young man, some accounts say he was a teenager, whereas others say he was at least 40 years old. His name was Daniel McInnes. He spotted strange lights among the trees of Oak Island, and knowing the islands were uninhabited and feeling rather curious, he went out to investigate. Upon arrival at the location that the light seemed to be coming from, he came across a small clearing in the woods, but no lights. Strange. What he did find, though, hanging above the clearing, was a sawn-off branch that hung from a tree at about 16 foot above the ground. Hanging from the branch was an aged and worn ship's pulley and some weathered rope. On the ground directly beneath the hanging pulley was a 13 foot in diameter circular depression in the ground. Interesting. McInnes' first thought was that something was buried here. The depression in the ground was clearly where earth had settled after the digging of a hole, and the pulley and rope above suggested something had been lowered into that hole. McInnes was keen to find out more. McInnes returned with two friends the following day, John Smith and Anthony Vaughan. Their first task was to view the depression in the ground from above. This was so that they could get an idea of scale from which they were working. McInnes climbed a tree and out onto the branch with the pulley. Right away he could see where the pulley had rubbed on the branch. A great deal of wear had occurred, indicating that the pulley had been used to lift and lower a large weight indeed. So in the centre of the depression, the three began digging. At the forefront of their minds the whole time was the local legend that somewhere in the vicinity Captain Kidd, the Scottish profiteer, had buried a significant amount of treasure for safekeeping in the area. This place had to be it, right? The three men got down to 2 feet, and they came across a number of flagstones. The stones are laid out flat across the 13-foot depression. They clear all the stones and dig down another 10 feet until they hit another marker. Closely bound oak logs laid out flat in another 13-foot diameter circle. The logs have clearly been placed accurately, as they are fastened into the walls of the shaft securely, kind of slotted into the clay walls to hold them in place. The three men also notice shovel and pick marks in the shaft wall from a previous dig. Convinced Captain Kidd's treasure is below, the boys remove the logs and feverishly continue to dig. They dig a further 10 feet and come to another oak platform, which they again remove.
Anyone who's gone to all this trouble must be trying to hide something worth a whole lot, they thought. Once again, they dug until they get to 30 feet down, and yet, again, another oak platform. Now, 30 feet is no small hole, and the three men start to wonder if this is too much work for just the three of them. 30 feet, after all, is a three-story building in depth. By now, the earth and logs have to be winched out. So deep is the hole, and for every foot deeper they go, the more laborsome the task becomes. In 1796, John Smith purchases the land that the hole was on, giving legitimacy to the treasure search, and meaning that they could legally search the site, although it's a further 6 years until a dig would resume. In 1802, a partner comes on board to help with the dig. His name is Simeon Lintz. He was the director of the Onslow Company, and what would be the first company to invest time and money into the search for whatever was buried at the bottom of the hole. The Onslow Company, alongside the three men, begin their dig. By now, a lot of the hole has closed back up since the three men started their dig 7 years prior. But they quickly arrive back at the 30-foot level again, and at another firm oak platform. They dig a further 10 feet to the 40-foot mark and discover another platform of oak. This one appears to be sealed completely airtight and watertight with some kind of clay or putty. Strange. Below this marker, the team discover a layer of coconut fibre. The fibre was used widely at the time as a packing material on ships, and as it didn't decay in seawater. It was fairly resistant to water and didn't break down as well. It always floated to the top. What's strange, though, is that Oak Island is at least 1,500 miles away from the nearest coconut tree. So it's unlikely that these fibres have floated all the way to Oak Island. Evidence that someone has put them there, possibly. They continue to dig, finding oak platforms every 10 feet until they get to the 90-foot mark. At 50 feet, they encountered a stone barrier with strange marking or code written on the stones. But at 90 feet, they discover a 500-pound stone slab marker. The stone slab is about a foot by a foot and a half in size. On the underside of the slab was an inscribed paragraph, but it was inscribed using an unknown cryptic code of strange symbols. To this day, the code has never been broken, and since around 1910, the stone has completely disappeared. It was last seen in a Halifax bookstore. Allegedly, sometime in the 1800s, James Leachy, a coding expert from the United States, using a substitution decipher, stated that the code read, "At 40 feet below, £2 million are buried." However, this is widely regarded as being hearsay, as substitution codes are, at best, considered a juvenile level of simplistic, even for the time period. Cryptic codes were popular between 1500 to 1900 as a way of hiding something in plain sight, and leaving meaningful messages before the digital age. So even the cryptic codes could be fairly complex back then. Think also that if you go into all the trouble of burying something so deep and difficult to retrieve, you aren't going to leave an easily solvable code for anyone to just resolve fairly straightforwardly. Speculation has also been rife around the code over the years, in that many believe that the given translation is said to maintain interest in the search, but without giving away anything secret that the men searching will not want the greater public to know. There was a version of the code published in the mid-19th century, which again, I personally don't believe, is the genuine code from the stone slab. I believe at one point, IBM analysed the purported code, and they said it almost certainly not the genuine code from the slab, and doesn't even translate the vocabulary that was used prior to the 1950s. So make of that what you will. I personally believe that a fake code was published. This would attract investors to the dig, but also keep the momentum up amongst the men working in the pit.
The real code can be kept amongst those at the top of the Onslow Company, in case the code's meaning is something fairly significant. What's important to stress here, though, is that the actual stone slab with the original cipher inscribed on it was seen by several hundred people over the years. John Smith actually installed the stone slab above his fireplace at home. It's just a shame that no one actually invested any time to actually decipher the code, choosing instead to greedily dig, dig, dig. Something you will see a lot of over the years ahead. So anyway, the slab stone is removed and the diggers decide to insert a drill bit to probe how far down they still have to dig. After 8 feet, they hit something hard. This excites them as the markers have all been at 10-foot intervals, but this was at a random 98 feet. They are convinced that this is it. 8 feet below, a special stone marker with a strange cipher inscribed has to be it, they thought. It's getting dark at this point, so the men call it a day, knowing that the next morning they will have their hands on the treasure. The next morning they arrive as eager as they ever have been, and as soon as the sun rises, surprised and devastated, they stare into the pit, deflated and defeated. Water has flooded to the top of the 30-foot mark. Overnight, 60 feet of water has poured into the pit from somewhere, and the men can't work out how. The pit isn't even near the shore, so it couldn't have been from the tide. There wasn't rain or a storm the previous night, so there wasn't a clear explanation of how water got into the pit. They were baffled. Regardless, the men needed to start bailing it out, and fast. They were still determined to retrieve the treasure that day. The men used large baling barrels and proceeded to remove barrel after barrel. Hours go by as they try to remove the water. Gallons and gallons get poured out. No matter how much they try, though, the water level doesn't seem to reduce at all. Not even by an inch does the water go down. There must be water coming in at the base of the pit somehow. The company decided to temporarily shut down operations so that they can regroup and come up with a plan. So, in the autumn of 1804, the Onslow Company paid Carl Mosher, a steam pump designer, a sum of £80 to use a pump that he has designed and developed primarily for the use in mining operations. It starts well, pumping the water out and back down to a level of 90 feet they go. But disaster strikes again and the pump bursts, rendering it both unusable and unrepairable. Temporarily defeated, the men go back to their daily lives and back to the drawing board once again. So, in 1805, a year later, they return once again. Their plan this time is to dig a new pit, around 14 feet southwest of the original pit, and then dig across to the original pit once they feel that they are below the water level in the original pit. So they dig pit 2 down to 110 feet without any flooding or issue. This was 20 feet lower than the original pit. Across they dig towards pit 1, and then it comes once again. Disaster as the second pit floods rapidly with water, and with the digging team very narrowly escaping death in the process. Exhausted, out of ideas, and out of funds, the Onslow Company folds in 1805 and abandon their treasure hunt. It's 46 years until any further action is taken on the island, but further action does indeed come. The Truro Company is formed in 1846 by Anthony Vaughan and Dr. David Barnes Lintz. If you recall, Anthony Vaughan was one of the original three men who began the very first dig after Daniel McInnes, who is by now dead, initially found the pit. The Truro Company don't begin work on the pit, however, until 1849, following 3 years of planning and research. Initially, the Truro Company built a number of neighbouring pits in more attempts to tunnel across to the original. But like previously attempted, these all fill with water very quickly. What the Truro Company does not notice, however, is that the water in the pits rises and falls with the tide. Further to this, members of the company walk down to Smith's Cove, which is the nearest beach to the pit at around 500 feet away. They notice that after the tide has gone out, there are various points in the sand where water is funneling out. It appears to be spouting out from the sand, like the island is expelling water somehow. So to investigate, the Truro Company erect a large metal coffer around Smith's Cove. Coffers are walls of metal used as a dam, which is, in this case, to encircle the cove. They are used mainly in construction below water levels and often by the Navy in erecting artificial harbours. By constructing a dam around the cove, they can keep the water out and investigate the cove, where they suspect the water is making its way to the pit. As expected, this brings further revelation. The Truro Company come to realise that Smith's Cove is actually artificial in itself. The entire cove is man-made. They also come across an elaborate water inlet funnel system, essentially a series of man-made stone inlet tunnels that allow water from the ocean to filter directly into the pit. The entire thing, the pit, whatever is at the bottom, the cove, is all an intelligent and elaborate construction. It doesn't get more Goonies than this. The inlet system has 5 separate entry points, with each measure about 4 foot by 2 foot in size, so big enough to allow a considerable amount of water in. The 5 pipes all recess down to a very steep 22 degree angle and converge at a singular point, although the company never actually found where that point was. The pipes are layered with clay and studded with pebbles and beach stones around the interior of the pipes, making water flow into them smoothly, but also providing support for the funnel system. About 17 inches into each tunnel, there is a coconut fibre filtration system, which keeps the sand out but allows only water through. Remember, the coconut fibre doesn't rot or degrade in seawater. No sooner have the company discovered all this, however, than a huge storm destroys the coffer and the sea floods the cove once again. What is very clear to the Truro Company is that this is a very sophisticated and well-designed booby trap system to protect something of great value. Whether that's financial, knowledge, or power, it is clearly cleverly designed by individuals of intelligence and great skill. By 1851, the Truro Company are convinced they have found the point where all 5 inlets join and block the connecting tunnel, sealing it from incoming water by driving timbers into the joint inlet tunnel. To their surprise, however, this makes no difference at all. Is there another inlet? Have they got the right location of the connection tunnel? As the water rushes into the tunnel once again, one of the last men who evacuated notices an item floating in the rushing water and grabs it just before he gets out. The item turns out to be a strange-looking painted wooden plate, the origin of which are not clear, but it's evidence that there is definitely something down there that is man-made. Unfortunately, the Truro Company will never know, as that same year the Truro Company dissolves after funds run out. In 1861, the Oak Island Association is formed by Anthony Groves, who has legally acquired most of the land. By now it's been 10 years since it was last worked on and the pit has completely collapsed in yet again. The association gets right to work, digging back down the pit, this time bringing a steam-powered pump to help remove water. There is unfortunately a tragic accident almost right away when the pump bursts and steam scalds an unknown worker to death. What's left of the body is unrecognizable. This causes the Oak Island Association to fold almost from the get-go. In 1866, the Oak Island El Dorado Company forms. Convinced they have the answer to the riddle of the pit, they construct a huge dam around Smith's Cove with the intent to block all water from having the ability to reach the island and stop the pit from flooding. Within days of the dam's completion and before work on investigating the pit and its water inlet system can begin, a huge storm once again destroys the entire dam and all the work that the company has put into the pit since they took over. So after a year of work on the dam and now out of funds, the Oak Island El Dorado Company goes bankrupt in 1867. Thus far, nearly $2.5 million have quite literally been sunk into the pit, and all treasure hunters involved remain at square one. The pit goes by the moniker the Money Pit for the first time, for there might be a wealth at the bottom, but there is certainly a great wealth being poured into the further excavation of the pit. 25 years later, in 1893, after a relatively quiet period in Money Pit lore, comes Fred Blair. Blair researches the Money Pit heavily and tries to gain as much factual information as he can before taking any physical action and spending any money.
He forms the Oak Island Treasure Company. Their plan is to block the water inlet tunnels so that they can dig without water flooding into the pit. They dig a new shaft about 30 feet east of the original pit, and this floods at 40 feet. So this pit is quickly abandoned. They then return to the original money pit and bring in a steam pump to remove the water. They drain the pit and are now at the 97 feet level. It is at this point in March 1897 that the pit claims its second life, when a pit worker by the name of Maynard Kaiser is being winched out of the pit, and as he's nearing the top, falls the length of the pit to his death. That's almost 10 stories. The death spooks a lot of other workers, and there remains a few weeks of stagnation where no one will go back into the pit. Superstitious times as it was. During this quiet period, however, the company locate the exact location of the 5 inlet tunnels. They drop dynamite into each one in the hope of caving them in and preventing the water from reaching the money pit. So work resumes on the pit, and a drill is bored down to 154 feet, at which point it hits what seems like concrete or stone, then oak, then loose pieces of metal. So it appears there is a wooden box encased in a cement surround. The box appears to be about 7 foot thick. Under the box and cement there is 11 feet of clay before the drill hit solid iron at 170 feet. The drill is unable to go through the iron, however, and that's as far as they can go at this point. What's significant here is that when the drill comes back up, it has brought with it a small 1-inch piece of parchment paper with the letters WI or VI written on it. This is analysed by Harvard University, who confirmed the paper to be parchment and that the writing was added by quill using Indian ink. They are unable to date the paper, though. In 1898, the company conducted the first dye test on the pit. They added bright red dye to the water so that when the tide goes out, they can see where it filters from by the coloration in the water. This is to ensure they have located and destroyed all the inlets. So sure enough, the tide goes out and dye appears in Smith's Cove, as expected, but also on the opposite side of the island. This lets them know that there is actually another inlet they weren't aware of. It's at this point in 1900 that the Oak Island Treasure Company runs out of money and ceases to exist. Even though his company has failed, Fred Blair continues to lease the land. Over the next few years, Fred would work with several investors who claimed that they had the solution to get in their hands on what was at the bottom of the money pit, including a Manhattan lawyer by the name of William Bowdoin, who had on his staff a young Franklin D. Roosevelt, who would later become President of the United States. He worked the pit for a number of months and followed the progress of the island for the rest of his days. Just before war broke out, he was actually scheduled to return to the pit to pay a visit. In 1931, Sophia Sellers dies, and she leaves her land to 12 of her heirs. Sophia Sellers was the daughter of Anthony Vaughan, who, if you recall, was one of the three members who originally found the island. She was the owner of most of Oak Island. Her heirs were not interested in leasing the land to Fred Blair any longer, and just wanted to sell it to get it off their hands. So, in 1935, Gilbert Hedden comes along and purchases the land for $5,000. Hedden, an engineer industrialist from New Jersey, is keen to explore the island when he takes over. And while his digs don't amount to much, he did make two pretty big discoveries in his time. In the cove, at the east of the island, Sheerdom Cove, he finds a boulder with Roman numerals for the number 2, and the letters G-I-N carved into it. Further, he also finds what became known as the H-stone, slightly north of the money pit in its location. The H-stone was a stone square slab, flat on one side with Masonic symbols carved into it. Hedden knew they were Masonic as soon as he saw them, because he was a Freemason himself. He was also well researched into the Mason's history. The symbols on the rock were a letter H, a circumpunct, and a Christian cross symbol. In Masonic symbology, the H represents the Creator, while the circumpunct can either mean eternity or the solar system. Finally, the cross refers to the Holy Trinity. According to Masonic scholar and 33rd level Freemason Manly P. Hall, the key to all knowledge is contained in the dot, the line, and the circle of the circumpunct. The dot is universal consciousness, the line is universal intelligence, and the circle is universal force. By 1941, 30 separate tunnels have been dug, over 100 boreholes to take drill samples, and a large amount of dynamiting. So much work has gone down, in fact, that the original pit that was dug back in 1795 is now lost, and no one is 100% sure of its exact location anymore. Also, at 1941, all work comes to a stop, as all available labour is needed for the war effort. In 1959, a further attempt at the pit is made by Robert Restall, business partner Carl Grazer, and Restall's 18-year-old son Robert Jr. Again, not much progress is made. However, they do come across a small pile of rocks near Smith's Cove, piled in a small pyramid formation. The top rock has 1704 carved into it. In August 1965, while working down a new shaft that they had dug, Robert Restall succumbed to hydrogen sulfide gas and fell to his death down into the pit. Seeing this, Robert's son, Carl Grazer, and one of their digging team, Cyril Grazer, all rushed into the shaft, and they too would all perish due to the deadly gas. The island has now claimed 6 lives. This now brings us up to modern times. In 1966, following the death of the Restall Group, the lease for the island was quickly taken over by Robert Dunfield, a California geologist who made his money in the petroleum industry. Right away, he went to work in constructing a causeway from the mainland to the island. This is so that he could bring heavy machinery onto the island. And bring it, he does. Several bulldozers and a 70-ton digging crane are brought to the money pit, and huge amounts of earth are removed. Dunfield digs out the pit to 134 feet in depth and a width of 100 feet. Pumps are used to keep all water out during the excavation. Dunfield, for all of his bombastic approach, does actually make a few discoveries. Firstly, at the island's southern cove, Dunfield, while trying to locate and block the second entry water inlet, finds and destroys in the excavation process a large stone, what appears to be a sextant of some kind, or navigational tool. We don't know exactly what it was, or for that matter what it looked like, as nothing, sadly, remains any longer. Further, while sinking a borehole, Dunfield hits a 2-foot-thick wooden beam, before the drill bit identifies a 42-foot cavity, or cove. This is at 140 feet beneath the surface, so the initial thoughts are that there is wood or an artificial ceiling to the cavity, be it man-made or natural, that is supported, so there is almost certainly a man-made element to this cavity, even if it is just to reinforce a natural expanse. The core sample hits metal at the cavity floor. However, in August 1966, Dunfield's lease runs out and a further excavation is halted. In January 1967, a new team take over the picture. They're called the Triton Alliance, led by Dan Blankenship, a construction engineer from Miami Beach in Florida. Blankenship was actually one of the investors of the previous team led by Robert Dunfield, but Blankenship was quite critical of Dunfield's methods, and he had his own ideas. He was backed by a multi-millionaire investor by the name of David Tobias, so they very much had deep pockets to work with. Blankenship's first task is to drill 65 boreholes all over the island. In doing so, a number of discoveries are made in the way of fine china, oak, cement, and charcoal, all at depths of between 160 to 200 feet. They have the oak carbon dated, which gives a year of 1575 as its creation date. Pollen samples taken from the boreholes also return a carbon date of around the same time, so the team have confidence in their estimations. They also recover a set of Spanish-American scissors, which the Smithsonian Museum estimates were from around the mid-1600s. Also, at Smith's Cove, they find a stone that is fashioned into the shape of a heart. They believe this to be a marker. Hearts and turtle-shaped stones were common markers used by pirates and profiteers throughout the 16th and 17th centuries. They would place them to be able to identify a location or tell others of a location of items that they had buried for safekeeping. There is a well-known story of a heart-shaped stone being used in the discovery of a stash of Captain Kidd's treasure in Haiti. Several piles of stone were also found at Smith's Cove, which hadn't been seen before. And beneath each pile was some strange kind of black ash which they didn't recognize. So they sent the ash off to be analyzed. After the results came back, they discovered that the ash was actually ground, burnt human bones. But possibly the most important and biggest find came when they drilled borehole 10X. At 230 feet, they decided to send a camera down to see what was down in the cavern. On the camera, they identified two wooden chests with handles on each side, an axe, and a severed human hand. They conduct a second camera drop into the same shaft, and this time, they see two tunnels leading out of the cavern, and, slumped in the corner, believed to be pickled due to the saline and lack of oxygen, appeared to be a dead human, slumped over, potentially standing guard. By now it's 1971, and for the first time in a great many years, real progress seems to be being made. However, between then and the mid-1990s, there was a great deal of disagreement on how the team should progress, and any progress essentially grinds to a halt once again. There is also a feud between the Triton Alliance and a surveyor by the name of Fred Nolan, which goes on throughout this period and results in many court cases and legal battles, which gets in the way of the progress. So who is this Fred Nolan? Nolan first came to Oak Island in the early 1970s. A land surveyor by trade who hailed from Halifax, Nova Scotia, Nolan grew more and more interested in Oak Island with the more stories and lore that he had heard. Nolan was level-headed, however, and more of a thinker than any of the treasure hunters that had come before him. He studied old maps and investigated every story and legend about the island that he could find. He requested permission from the Triton Alliance to access the island and take part in a treasure hunt, but he was denied. Failing that, he notified them that he was a qualified and experienced land surveyor and offered to survey the entire island for free. The Triton Alliance granted him permission to do this, as it had never been undertaken before. Tension arose between Nolan and the Triton Alliance grew in the late 1970s when Nolan noticed some anomalies in the land purchasing paperwork and discovered that Triton didn't actually loan the land that they thought they did. So Nolan craftily bought up the land on the island himself, and thus began a legal war that would go on for nearly 30 years. Today, Blankenship owns a 50% share in the island, along with newcomers Rick and Marty Legina. It's the Leginas, through their Michigan group, who continue to search the location for what's buried at the bottom of the money pit. To this day, no one knows for sure what's at the bottom of the pit. There are many theories, but no evidence as yet. During the 224-year search to date, it is only Fred Nolan who has researched and attempted to decipher the clues and codes left on the island. Unfortunately, much of what Fred deduced went to his grave with him when he passed away in 2016. Unfortunately, since the discovery of the pit, man's greed has fueled his lust for treasure and riches and completely overtaken any rational approach or intelligent thought on how to overcome the complex system that lies beneath the surface of Oak Island. What's certain is that over $15 million have been spent trying to reach the bottom, possibly more wealth that is even at the bottom of the pit. During the 19th century, word of mouth got around that a curse had been placed on the island by whoever built the pit, and that curse stipulated that seven must die before the mysteries of the money pit will be solved. Well, as we stated earlier, thus far, only six men have died in the search of buried treasure at this point. So what are the most realistic theories of what might be down at the bottom of the money pit? Aside from the usual suspects featuring aliens, the lost city of Atlantis, King Arthur, and numerous other fast legends of the crazy and unlikely, there are actually a few credible contenders to the lore. Pirates. So as fantastic as this might sound, buried pirate treasure being at the bottom of the pit is a very strong contender. Early theories that were spoken of in the area attributed the treasure as being that of Captain Kidd, the world-famous Scottish privateer who, legend has it, used Oak Island as a community bank with legendary pirate John Avery. Further tales have stated that one of Blackbeard's largest treasure hauls could also be buried on Oak Island. For Blackbeard the pirate stated that where he buried his loot, only him and Satan will ever find it. Given the time period, it has also been suggested that the pit was created by the British, with naval marines digging the pit to store the loot acquired from the British invasion of Cuba in 1762. Valued at about £1 million of loot back then, or about £180 million in today's value, this would certainly be a valuable sum to find. William Shakespeare. In his 1953 book, The Oak Island Enigma, author Penn Leary wrote that the pit was used to hide manuscripts indicating that Francis Bacon was the real author of William Shakespeare's works, and also a leader of the Rosicrucians, a spiritual and cultural movement that arose in the 17th century Europe. For me, this theory doesn't hold that much water, however. Shakespeare was indeed popular at the time of his death in April of 1616. However, he was certainly not regarded in the category higher than most others. In fact, according to the British Council of Culture, it wasn't until the mid-1700s that the reputation of Shakespeare became one of general, universal acclaim. And by this point, carbon dating has indicated that the money pit would have already been constructed and possibly for some time. So what has Shakespeare's reputation and wide regard got to do with the money pit? Well, if there was indeed evidence at the bottom of the money pit proving that Francis Bacon wrote Shakespeare's plays, then there would have had to have been speculation enough that Shakespeare didn't write his plays. Further, and as we know, the money pit took some time, expertise, knowledge, and intelligence to create. Do you think such resources would have been spent to hide the fact that a playwright, considered at the time to be just one of a crowd, would have been likely? Would Francis Bacon have been this presumptuous? All this aside, of course, it wasn't until 1848 that Joseph P. Hart first questioned Shakespeare's authorship. He was the first to do so at a time when to question famous authorships was fairly commonplace. To name just a small few, both Homer's Epics and the Christian Bible were two other works where literary scholars challenged their true authorship. The Knights Templar. Like the speculation of pirate treasure, I think this is an outcome that holds significant credence. The Knights Templar were a Catholic Christian military order founded in 1119. They were created by a French knight who fought in the Crusades, created with the support of King Baldwin of Jerusalem. The reason for the creation was originally as a protectorate of Christian pilgrims making their way to the Holy Land, which was often fraught and dangerous and littered with bandits. As they became more established, the Templars, as well as giving protection to pilgrims, also founded possibly the world's first banking system. Pilgrims would deposit their wealth at one of the many European Templar locations and be given a ticket. This ticket would guarantee their deposit. Pilgrims could then travel without the fear of being robbed and cash in their ticket at other Templar locations. Such a success was the system that the Knights Templar would become one of the wealthiest organizations in the world, accountable only to the Pope. In 1307, King Philip IV of France, who was heavily in debt to the Templars, had many of the Templars rounded up, arrested, and tortured into giving false confessions. This would lead to many of the order being burned at the stake. Pope Clement V would officially order the disbandment of the Templars in 1312. But many escaped, initially to Scotland, which had been excommunicated by the Catholic Church. There are numerous legends and stories that have been handed down through the generations that say the Knights Templars may have also escaped to other parts of the world in a vow to protect their hoards of artifacts, knowledge, treasures, and mystical items. One of the locations they were rumored to have also fled to is what is now Nova Scotia, which interestingly means New Scotland. A few of the artifacts that were swore to protect, of course, was the Holy Grail, the cup of Christ from the Last Supper that caught his blood while he was nailed to the cross. Further, and after taking it under the protection from the Temple of Solomon, was the Ark of the Covenant, a solid gold chest which was said to hold God's Ten Commandments amongst an array of fantastic powers to whoever possessed it. What do you believe sits beyond the booby traps, lurking in the darkness between the sands of Oak Island? Whatever it is remains there to this day, entwined in a system that has baffled men for over 200 years. And who knows, maybe we will have to see the death of one more man, as the legend goes, before we will uncover the island's answers. and mysteries. Thanks for listening tonight, everyone. We'll be back soon, so make sure you subscribe so you don't miss an episode. This week, we're also launching the first of our midweek short episodes that we will call the Midweek Mausoleum. 10 to 15 minute short stories and current events in the media. Hopefully you'll come back and check those out with us. Anyway, find us on Instagram at dead_souls_podcast for daily mysteries and dark history and, of course, podcast updates. And check out our Patreon for cool extras and rewards at patreon.com/deadsouls. So take care of yourselves, everyone, and sleep tight. And remember, stand firm as you enter the darkest night.